Today is Monday, March 9th. Today is Monday, March 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Afghanistan has not one but two presidents.
Situation is very tense politically in Kabul because each of them is saying that their leader is the legitimate president. It is certainly not a good omen for the country.
Plus, why does Africa have so few cases of the COVID-19 coronavirus? And North Korea resumes missile tests. These stories and more are next. Afghanistan's two presidential contenders were both sworn in as president in two separate ceremonies Monday, throwing the country into an unprecedented political crisis and putting scheduled talks with Taliban insurgents on indefinite hold. The two inauguration ceremonies were delayed, apparently to allow for hectic U.S. diplomacy to resolve the crisis, but after several hours, incumbent Ashraf Ghani and challenger Abdullah Abdullah went ahead with their swearing-ins anyway. Ghani was the first to take the oath, but both ceremonies were broadcast live by all Afghan television stations, some showing the two events on split screens. The Afghan Election Commission late last month declared Ghani the winner of the bitterly contested September 28th presidential election, but Abdullah, the country's incumbent chief executive, rejected the outcome as fraudulent, claiming that he had won. The political uncertainty poses a serious challenge to last week's landmark deal signed by the United States and the Taliban insurgency aimed at ending nearly two decades of war. That deal paved the way for a so-called intra-Afghan dialogue with the Taliban, Afghan political forces, and civil society to negotiate a ceasefire and find political solutions to the country's internal conflicts. But VOA journalist Ayaz Ghul says the fresh inauguration crisis is likely to hamper those efforts. I spoke to him earlier today.
Situation is very tense politically in Kabul because now both the camps, one led by Ashraf Ghani and the other Abdullah Abdullah, each of them is saying that their leader is the legitimate president. So it is certainly not a good omen for the country at a very critical time when the United States is making these hectic efforts to bring stability to Afghanistan with the help of all Afghan stakeholders. And now we see this deeply divided political elite in Kabul that was supposed to be a united group to go forward and engage in peace negotiations with the Taliban as per the agreement Washington has recently signed with this insurgent group.
Has there been a reaction from the Taliban to this latest development?
A brief statement from one of the Taliban spokes said that this political standoff between Abdullah and Ghani is not a good sign for peace prospects in the country. But again, this is the first time that the Taliban are being seen as a unified group in a country where most of the people do not like this group because of its extremist policies and the kind of insurgency it has waged over the years. But now we see that they are sort of being seen as good cops. And here we have two senior politicians, high-profile figures in Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah, who are now contesting each other's leadership. This is really a major challenge now to these nascent peace efforts that had created hopes after the signing of the agreement more than a week ago that maybe finally Afghanistan is on the way to some kind of peace and stability. But this political crisis is really going to undermine those efforts.
Has there been any talk of perhaps a power-sharing deal, or is there any way that there could be some sort of judicial intervention or ruling or something to decide who actually is the legitimate president?
The constitution of Afghanistan, unfortunately, was never drafted in a way that it has to deal with a situation where one group will reject the election and declare itself the legitimate winner. And so there is no legal way out. But what we saw today at these two parallel ceremonies, U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. Commander of International Forces in Afghanistan, and acting U.S. Ambassador to Kabul, all three of them together with representatives of European Union, Canada, and other Western countries, they were present at President Ashraf Ghani's swearing-in ceremony, which shows that international community has endorsed Ashraf Ghani's presidency rather than going and attending Abdullah's. But if you look inside Afghanistan, Abdullah seems to be having much more support especially from the political elite in Afghanistan, because former President Hamid Karzai, who is sort of a legendary figure in Afghanistan, did not attend President Ghani's ceremony. Similarly, there were other senior politicians who sided with Abdullah in this situation. So even though international community has endorsed, apparently, Ashraf Ghani to be the president, but with Abdullah having this kind of a popularity and support, this political crisis is likely to deepen further. The main focus of the international community is going to be resolving this crisis rather than worrying about an intra-Afghan dialogue involving Taliban insurgents so that these hostilities that have continued for decades could be ended. This peace agreement that the United States signed with the Taliban a week ago requires that intra-Afghan peace negotiations should begin on Tuesday, that is tomorrow. But with this political crisis, there is no chance of this process going ahead.
There were reports of two explosions that went off today as these inaugurations were taking place. Is there any update about what happened with those blasts?
There were a couple of rockets that were launched from some kind of a military vehicle not far from the presidential palace where President Ashraf Ghani was being sworn in, but it did not cause any casualties. It just damaged few vehicles. Nobody has claimed responsibility, but President Ashraf Ghani's people are seeing it as some loyalist of Abdullah's camp. But there has been no violence as of this moment other than these two rockets that were fired. But the tensions are really running high in Kabul, in Afghanistan.
That was VOA correspondent Ayaz Gul in Kabul. Turkish and European leaders are holding talks Monday evening aimed at resolving a weeks-long crisis at the border of Turkey and Greece. Tens of thousands of people, many of them refugees, have been trying to get into Greece, only to be stopped by security forces who at times have fired tear gas. The attempted border crossings came after Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan said last month that Turkey would no longer try to keep refugees on its territory, as agreed in 2016 in return for aid for refugees from Europe. Turkey hosts over 3 million refugees, mainly from Syria, where its troops are facing off against Russian-backed Syrian government forces. The EU says it has so far paid about half the money it promised to Turkey. About a million more people are displaced in Syria's rebel stronghold Idlib province, which borders Turkey, raising fears in Ankara of yet another influx from Syria if a shaky ceasefire in the province, struck last week, collapses. At tonight's talks, Erdogan is expected to seek European financial support as well as political and military support from the EU and NATO against Syrian government attacks against rebels in Idlib. But EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has drawn a hard line on further entries of refugees and migrants.
It was the Turkish president who said the European borders are open. They are not open, they were not open, and they are not open. And therefore, we have to start to talk between the conflicting parties to find a solution that this, what we saw over the last weekend, will not happen again. We are already progressing, but we are not at the point where we want to be.
Athens has complained that the rest of the EU has not done its share to take in more people, leaving Greece, one of the poorest EU countries, to deal with the influx from Turkey. Von der Leyen said there needed to be more support for both Greece and Turkey.
Finding a solution to this situation will require relieving the pressure that is put on the border and ensuring that the individual right to ask for asylum is respected. And it will require supporting both Greece and Turkey to deal with the pressure they are under.
In Berlin, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis accused Turkey of blackmailing Greece into accepting its demands.
Αναγνώριζε και αναγνωρίζει ότι η Τουρκία έχει να διαδραματίσει.
He said, "We have always recognized and continue to recognize that Turkey plays a critical role in managing the refugee problem and is dependent on Europe's help. However, this cannot happen, I think this is clear to everyone, under conditions of blackmail and threats, with persecuted people being used for geopolitical ambitions." Also in Berlin, German Chancellor Angela Merkel echoed Mitsotakis' sentiment, but added that, quote, the EU-Turkey agreement must be taken into a new phase, end quote. Global stock markets and oil prices plunged Monday after a squabble among crude producers jolted investors who already were on edge about the surging costs of the virus outbreak. The main stock indices in London and Frankfurt dropped by more than 6%. Tokyo closed down 5.1%, while Sydney lost 7.3% and Shanghai was off by 3%. The benchmark U.S. crude price fell as much as 30%, deepening a rout that began when Saudi Arabia, Russia, and other major producers failed to agree on how much to cut output to prop up prices. In Saudi Arabia, the Riyadh Stock Exchange suspended trading of state-owned oil giant Saudi Aramco after its share price sank by the daily 10% limit at opening. Three Russians and a Ukrainian went on trial Monday in the Netherlands, charged with multiple counts of murder for their alleged involvement in the 2014 downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, which killed 298 people. The suspects did not appear in the courtroom, but under Dutch law, the trial can continue even if the suspects don't show up. And Sudan's prime minister said Monday he survived a, quote, terror attack, end quote, after an explosion and gunfire targeted his motorcade in the capital of Khartoum. Abdullah Hamdok tweeted he was, quote, safe and in good shape, end quote, following the explosion. Sudanese state TV said Hamdok had been heading to his office when the attack took place. You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2012, NASA's Kepler spacecraft discovered three odd exoplanets circling a 500 million-year-old star some 2,400 light-years away. 2 years later, scientists found that the planets seemed to have a lower density than any planet in the solar system, and that they appeared to be light, fluffy, and resembled cotton candy, the favorite circus treat. A team of scientists led by researchers at the University of Colorado Boulder recently used the Hubble Space Telescope to confirm these earlier findings and find that the planets in the Kepler-51 star system represent a new class of exoplanets nicknamed superpuffs. According to NASA, although they each have a mass that's no more than several times that of Earth, because of their atmospheres of hydrogen and helium are so bloated, they are nearly the size of Jupiter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin. More than 110,000 people have been infected by the COVID-19 coronavirus across the world, and over 3,800 have died. Albania, Bulgaria, Colombia, Bangladesh, and the Maldives all reported their first cases over the past few days. A patient diagnosed with the coronavirus died in Argentina on Saturday, marking the first death related to the virus in Latin America. Europe has borne the brunt of the virus outside Asia. Italy has reached 7,375 cases with 366 deaths. The government there shut off much of the country's north, which is the industrial and business heartland, to combat the crisis. Germany on Monday reported 210 new cases, taking its total to over 1,100. Meanwhile, total cases in the United Kingdom rose by 30% to 273, and a third person has died there. Britain said Monday anyone returning from northern Italy will be placed under lockdown and must self-isolate for 14 days. Also on Monday, Iran said it released around 70,000 prisoners because of the outbreak. Iran said Sunday 194 people had died and 6,566 were now infected. Nigeria has a second confirmed case, its health minister said on Twitter on Monday. And in the U.S., the virus has reached the capital, Washington, D.C. Authorities believe it was brought here by a Nigerian traveler. Major events continue to be canceled around the world in hopes of limiting the outbreak's spread, including the Indian Wells Tennis Tournament, which is one of the most prestigious tennis events each year. As the COVID-19 coronavirus spreads around the world, so do myths and rumors about the outbreak. Here at VOA, we want to tackle those rumors head-on so that you, our listeners, have the best, most up-to-date information about the disease. Today, we air our second installment in a new series where we hear from trusted health experts to address the truth about the many myths and rumors spreading by word of mouth and on social media about COVID-19. Last week, we discussed where the virus comes from and how it spreads. Today's topic is about who is at risk, especially in Africa. So far, the African continent has had very few COVID-19 cases, only a few dozen total in Egypt, Algeria, Morocco, Senegal, Nigeria, Cameroon, and South Africa. To find out why there are so few cases in Africa, I spoke with Dr. Elizabeth Radin, an epidemiologist at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York. Here's a clip of our conversation. One rumor that's been going around a lot on WhatsApp, particularly in Africa, is the idea that people with dark skin are somehow protected from the virus, and maybe that's an explanation for why so far there have been very few reported cases in Africa. Other people are saying that it's due to the warm weather in Africa, and somehow the disease can't survive in that warmer weather, and so that's why there are fewer reported cases. Any truth to any of these? Any evidence for either of these?
So I don't think there's any evidence or any plausible biological explanation as to why skin tone would be protective against the virus. The question about weather is also an outstanding one. I don't think we have any reason to make a safe assumption that the weather would prevent the transmission of the virus. So we do know that for some viruses like the flu or coronaviruses like some of the common cold, there is a seasonality and we do see less transmission in warmer weather. However, there are other forms of coronavirus, such as the MERS virus, which transmit consistently across colder and warmer weather and don't show the same kind of seasonality pattern. So the weather example is also not a good bet and certainly not a reason that we should just, you know, wait it out till the summer comes in the Northern Hemisphere, or we should assume that anywhere that has warm weather now is not at risk. Now, to the interesting question of, you know, why have there been fewer cases in Africa? I think there's a few kind of plausible theories going around about this. One being that travel flows between the most heavily affected parts of China and countries in Africa are somewhat lighter. Two is that there's certainly an element of luck here. There's globally, compared to the global population, still relatively few people who are infected by the virus. So the chances of just having a certain person come in contact with a certain person and then travel, there is an element of randomness and potentially luck in that. To the point about travel flows, there was an interesting article in the Lancet Medical Journal recently analyzing data about air travel to and from Africa and China and suggesting that based on travel patterns, the countries that would be most at risk would be Algeria, Egypt, and South Africa, and that those did in fact turn out to be several of the first countries that had nationals affected. There were cases in Algeria, in Egypt, and South African nationals who are outside of South Africa were affected. There's also cases reported now in Senegal and Nigeria. I think the last explanation that I've heard about this that is less plausible is that there's very widespread transmission, but either it's gone undetected or there's an active cover-up. It does appear from the experience in multiple countries that once the virus arrives, particularly if there's a limited response, it spreads pretty quickly. It's not really plausible that there are hundreds or thousands of cases that have simply gone undetected, let alone that we'd see the level of coordination required across many different actors, from families to health systems, that would be needed if there was some kind of active cover-up. So I think it really has to do with the travel flows and a little bit of luck.
Could it also have to do with the experience that a lot of African countries have with dealing with outbreaks? Of course, the Ebola outbreak, there have been two Ebola outbreaks in recent years in Africa, and African countries have really stepped up their screening at borders, both land borders and at airports. Could that be helping African countries, that skill and that capacity and experience, could that be helping in this case?
I think that's potentially a great resource here. I think the cases that are coming in are, you know, are a bit due to other factors, but certainly the ability to control and manage, put in place appropriate screening and infection control procedures are critical in preventing, you know, a couple of cases from rapidly growing to hundreds or thousands of cases. So it's certainly an asset that those public health systems, those health security systems are in place in a number of countries and that capacity and experience is there in a number of places, particularly in West Africa and in the DRC, where they've dealt with recent outbreaks in particular in relation to Ebola. That's certainly an asset, and it speaks to the value in developing these systems so that they're in place and ready to go and the local capacity exists when a new outbreak occurs.
That was Dr. Elizabeth Radin, an epidemiologist at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York. Tune into VOA's International Edition on Tuesday when Dr. Radin will tackle rumors about whether age or gender affects susceptibility to the disease. Continuing our COVID-19 coverage, a United Nations investigator Monday warned of serious consequences if COVID-19 gains a foothold in North Korea and urged the government there to accept international offers of help to contain the spread of the deadly virus. VOA's Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in North Korea, Thomas Ojea Quintana, says the lack of freedoms and wide range of abuses in the tightly controlled, highly secretive society run counter to the transparency needed to combat the coronavirus epidemic. Ojea Quintana acknowledges the government's extensive efforts in preventing an outbreak of this virus inside the North. He warns a widespread infection in North Korea would be devastating for the people, as many are malnourished, suffering from stunted growth, and are vulnerable to getting sick. The UN official is calling on North Korea to allow full and unimpeded access to medical experts and aid workers and urges the government not to restrict access to vital information. The government in Pyongyang has not publicly disclosed any cases of COVID-19.
Measures to contain and combat the spread of COVID-19, such as lockdowns and quarantines, as well as treatment of patients, should be carried out in strict accordance with human rights standards. Further isolation of the country is not the answer. The international community must respond accordingly and offer medical and scientific assistance.
The United States and other countries have imposed economic sanctions on North Korea because of its nuclear weapons program. Ojea Quintana says sanctions create economic hardships for the people, and given the coronavirus crisis, they should be reviewed. The North Korean delegation boycotted the UN Council session and did not avail itself of its right of reply as the concerned country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
On Monday, North Korea test-fired three short-range rockets. It is the second North Korean launch in a week and the latest mixed signal from Pyongyang, which has hinted it wants international help to fight the COVID-19 outbreak. More from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
South Korean officials say the North used multiple rocket launchers to fire the short-range weapons into the sea off Korea's east coast. Japan said they appeared to be ballistic missiles. North Korea's second missile launch in a week may signal a return to tensions, except the North is also hinting at dialogue. In a surprise move last week, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un sent a letter of condolence to South Korea, which has seen an explosion of coronavirus cases. Some analysts believe Kim's friendly letter signals he wants economic or virus-related aid. North Korea has not reported any coronavirus infections, but many fear it is hiding an outbreak that could turn into a humanitarian disaster. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Millions of women in Mexico and Argentina stay away from offices, school, and government offices on Monday, stepping up historic protests against gender violence that saw hundreds of thousands take to the streets over the weekend. The one-day action, dubbed, quote, "a day without us," end quote, is intended to show what life would be like if women vanished from society. In Mexico, the strike stems from a surge in disappearances of women and femicides, or gender-motivated killings of women. Femicides in Mexico jumped 137% in the past 5 years, government statistics show, as gang violence pushed the national murder tally to record heights. Most violent crimes go unsolved. On Sunday, women took to the streets in unprecedented numbers across Latin America as part of International Women's Day, demanding abortion rights and action from leaders to stem the violence. The mostly peaceful protests saw anger boiling over into some outbreaks of violence, such as Molotov cocktails thrown at Mexico's National Palace after the killing of a 7-year-old and the murder and skinning of a young woman shocked the nation. That's it for us today. You have been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, John Dryden, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and have a great evening.